Thank you very much, President Booth. I haven't had such a fine greeting since I returned from that trip. I expected you to embrace me. I've been visiting here with my luncheon partner, John Cosgrove, and he said, you know, Mr. Vice President, you're in a pretty big league when you're around the National Press Club. And I said, I know that. Don't shake me up any more than I am. he said, you're following Jimmy Durante. And you're preceding Governor Brown. Frankly, I'm coming out for Durante strong right now. Now, don't you tell Pat I said that, because I'm a close personal friend and strong political advocate of the good governor of California. Amen. I recall my other visit to the National Press Club, and in this particular situation, I've been out here where we've had a good time on those congressional nights that I've never reported to Mrs. Humphrey. I've told her that they lasted till 2 a.m., and all of you have kindly followed the same yarn. But I remember in 1960 when Muriel and my mother were sitting there in the gallery. That was 1960. And I want you to know that while I've read in the press of late that I'm somewhat of an optimist, why shouldn't I be? Look where I am in 1966. If you can recall what happened in 1960 to me. And our late and beloved friend and the great president of the United States, John Kennedy, said as he followed me the week or so afterwards that he regretted deeply that his beloved mother could not be with him, but he was having May Craig sit in for him, and she was up there. If I'd have known that, Muriel, you'd never been here the first time. But you really honored Mrs. Humphrey, myself, by your gracious invitation to Muriel to be here. She did join us on this journey. She did not, however, I want to say to the distinguished ambassadors, ministers, and chargés, join us on the first part of the journey. She let me go to Honolulu alone. By that time, the president had even left. She let me go to Saigon alone. It's a very beautiful country with beautiful people. She let me go to Thailand alone, and that was a very beautiful country and beautiful people. She let me go to Laos alone, and we had such a wonderful reception there with beautiful young ladies giving us garlands and flowers galore, and she let me go to Pakistan alone. By that time, the word had gotten back what I was doing. And she met me at New Delhi. And from there on out, I want you to know that our conduct was beyond reproach. With the exception of some that our conduct was beyond reproach. Earlier this morning, or today, I met at the State Department with members of the congressional staffs, committees, congressmen, and senators. As a moderator, or program director, so to speak, with Secretary Rusk and Secretary McNamara making the presentation and fielding the questions. I was sort of permitted to give both the invocation and the benediction, being of the spiritual type myself. And while I was concluding my remarks, I indicated that there had been a conversation in my office last evening which sort of told me what my position was in public life. I did this because I had to tell these fine, distinguished public servants that a vice president does not make policy, He doesn't even administer it. But there was an Associated Press reporter with me, and I want to say we had a splendid visit. And he looked up and he saw the vice presidential seal. And he said to me, "I've been worried about that." He said, "When did it happen?" I tried to trace the history of it. I don't know whether it was accurate, but I was positive in what I had to say anyway. And after my dissertation about the history of the vice presidential seal, he said, "But," he says, "I've been bothered." He said, "The wings look sort of drooped." I said, "Well, this is one of the ways to remind a vice president what his position is in this country." If you've ever noticed the presidential seal, the wings are up. In mine, it's always for a soft landing someplace. I guess our spacemen would say the flaps were down, but some people are not sure that always applies to me. And then this gentleman... Then this gentleman said to me, he said, "Well, there's something else that disturbs me about that seal, Mr. Vice President." I said, "Yes, I really, up to this time, I thought it was quite a seal." But, he said, "I noticed," he said, "that the eagle," we've described the eagle now with its shortcomings and the vice presidential seal. And he said, "I noticed, of course, that the eye of the eagle and the head of the eagle is turned towards the olive branch." And he said, "I noticed that the claws of your eagle has as many olive branches as the claws of the presidential eagle." Well, at this moment, I felt pretty good because I am a peace-loving man. And then he said, "But," he said, "the other claw has but one arrow." I said, "Just another reminder of where a man stands in this government." Now, I give all of this background to you, and this is all, of course, very much off the record, this part. Don't you let it get over to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue for a minute. I give you this because I think the ground rules are pretty well known, and you're really not going to get all the inside information that you ought to have. I won't admit for a minute that I don't know it, but you're not going to get it. So, gentlemen of the National Press Club and your guests, it's been my privilege in the last 2.5 months to have traveled on behalf of our country some 96,000 miles. Only recently I returned after a mission on behalf of the President of the United States to 9 Asian and Pacific nations. Earlier I had visited other nations, Japan and Taiwan, over and above the 9 of this recent trip. And I'm very honored by the presence of the ambassadors of the Republic of China and of Japan here today. I want to share with you some of my observations and conclusions as I see them as to what is happening in that part of the world and about our policy there. Yes, I'm frank to tell you that I found this journey very, very interesting and exciting, and also very revealing. Some people have commented to the fact that it was like an awakening for the vice president. I hope so. I hope that each and every one of us, as we travel or journey or visit, that we learn something. And I'm going to begin my message today with the words of a great Asian philosopher, leader, Confucius. Confucius said, "If a man take no thought about what is distant, he will find sorrow near at hand." I wish that somewhere in our lives that our founding fathers had stated what Confucius had said. Because we've paid the price many times for taking no thought about what is distant and finding sorrow near at hand. So I come directly to the subject that is foremost in our minds, Vietnam. And the war in Vietnam is far more than Neville Chamberlain's famous quote, "A quarrel in a remote country among people of whom we know nothing." This dear man was speaking of Czechoslovakia. I speak of Vietnam. And we do know something. And it is not remote. It is less remote now than London was 25 years ago. It is less remote now than Pearl Harbor was December 7th, 1941. In fact, to me, Vietnam is the focus of a broader conflict, which in a very real sense involves the whole Asian continent, one way or another. It also includes basic principles of international conduct to which we have given our commitment. And I'm going to return to this. So let me ask the question which you're asked every day and which many of you ask us. Why are we in Vietnam, in South Vietnam? Well, we're there primarily because we were asked and because we have commitments, because we have treaties. We're there to repel and prevent the success of aggression against the government and against the people of that country. And we're there, too, to help assure the South Vietnamese people the right to decide their own futures freely and without intimidation. And we are there to help those people achieve a better standard of living for themselves and their children and their posterity. And we are there to help establish the principle that in this nuclear age, a terrifying age, aggression cannot be an acceptable means either of settling international disputes or of gaining political power or realizing national objectives. And ladies and gentlemen, those principles and observations are as American and as much a part of our history as the 4th of July. Now, if aggression is permitted to go unchecked, I believe that we cannot in good faith hold out much hope for the future of small nations or of world peace. And there are over 100 small nations that could live at the tentative mercy of the giants of this earth if the pattern of aggression becomes an international habit. Every small nation has an interest in what develops in Southeast Asia. This, to me, is why we're in Vietnam. We are not there to build any empire, to exercise any domination for conquest, or to take over that part of the world. We threaten no regime. We seek no war with any country, nor are we there to establish military bases. We are not there either to impose a government or a way of life on other peoples. We're there to let them make their own way of life. Now, that last point is worth dwelling on. The National Liberation Front claims to be the authentic nationalist movement in South Vietnam, representing the overwhelming majority of the Vietnamese people. Now, I agree with one part of the National Liberation Front's contention, namely that it is a front. There was a time in the colonial days when the old Viet Minh movement contained authentic nationalists, and many of them are now, I might add, members of the South Vietnamese government. Some are here at this table. Today, there are a few non-communists in the figurehead positions of the Viet Cong. It's as old a trick as anyone ever knew. The nominal leader of the NLF, for example, is not known as a communist. But most of the Viet Cong soldiers, at least those defecting or captured, don't even know his name. I believe, if I'm correct, and my pronunciation is not nearly as good as the distinguished president of this club, who, by the way, of course, is a great internationalist, being for the National Geographic. But I believe his name is Nguyen Hu To. I didn't know about him. The Viet Cong doesn't know about him, but they all know about Ho Chi Minh. Now, there are in the NLF leaders of alleged non-communist parties, but they are parties without any apparent membership. There are a good many well-known and recognized nationalists in South Vietnam outside the present government. And quite a few of them opposed the late President Diem. Some of them suffered in prison for their opposition. But to this date, my fellow Americans and our friends from other lands, not one of these people has identified himself with the National Liberation Front. Not one. Yet it would be easy for any one of them to slip into Viet Cong territory and do so. None has. And you can be sure that if anyone had, the National Liberation Front would have told the world about it. Now, the same is true of the religious leaders, the Catholics and the Buddhists and others, of the trade unionists, who, by the way, I met with when I was in Saigon, of student leaders. They differ widely among themselves. The Vietnamese, we've now learned, are an articulate and argumentative people. But on one thing at least they agree. They don't want to live under communist rule. Now, twice in recent months, the National Liberation Front has tried to demonstrate its strength by calling a general strike, a general uprising. Now, this is a tactic which you and I know has been used very successfully by authentic nationalist movements elsewhere. But in Vietnam, it was a colossal failure. It had no popular support. And then, contrary to what many people believe, you do not have to have an overwhelming or even majority support to wage guerrilla war. A determined, highly organized, well-disciplined, trained minority can do just that. Without massive American aid to the Greek government after the war, after World War II, the communists would have taken over that country. Yet subsequent elections have shown them to be a small, noisy minority. Without the aid of the British and the Gurkha troops, over a period of many years, the communists would have won in Malaya. But subsequent elections have shown them to be an even smaller minority than their Greek comrades. With outside aid, the overwhelming majority of the South Vietnamese people would have no hope of self-determination. They would be ruled by force and coercion, as they are today in areas under Vietnam or Viet Cong control. And we're giving aid. Military aid, political and economic and social aid, and we'll continue to give it. On the military front, the Vietnamese, together with American and allied troops, have made substantial progress in the past few months. I returned and said, I have reason for encouragement, restrained optimism. A series of defeats have been inflicted on the main force, units of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese soldiers. And Allied forces have been able to move into Viet Cong strongholds, which had previously been immune to attack for 10, 15 years. We've been able to open up stretches of highway and railroad, which the Viet Cong had long controlled. Mobility and firepower of the Allied forces is impressive, and coordination amongst command and the Allied forces is improved. Viet Cong and North Vietnamese casualties, while difficult to determine, are high. But the best available figures show that they have doubled over 1964 and are now running several times the current Allied casualties. These are some of the reasons that I said we had reason for encouragement. And the defection rate for the Viet Cong has also increased. You know this, but it bears restatement, partly because of the special South Vietnamese program to encourage defection, the Open Arms program. Defectors have been received at the rate of 2,000 per month while I was in Saigon. Defectors report shortages of food and low morale. They report that the accuracy and the impact of our artillery and bombing has been devastating. They don't know what to do about B-52s and the close air support that is provided. But we don't have to rely on the words of the defectors or our own generalizations. An article published in the January issue of the Viet Cong Theoretical Journal and broadcast over its radio complains of difficulty and confusion in its ranks. It says the Viet Cong agents, having organized protest movements in the villages, sometimes lose control of it and even allow it to be transformed into an anti-communist demonstration. It warns, although its agitators must use all sorts of people, partially and temporarily, in carrying out the struggle, that they must wipe out any influence of reactionary elements belonging to various religious organizations and beware of trade union leaders. A number of articles and broadcasts warn of defeatism and pacifism in their ranks. General Giap has publicly complained from Hanoi that the American commitment to Vietnam has given rise to an extremely serious situation. An article recently published in Hanoi denounces a small number of comrades who see only difficulties and not opportunities and display pessimism, perplexity, and a reluctance to protracted resistance. They even have trouble in Hanoi. Peking, in more general terms, has acknowledged, and I quote now, that in some lands, revolutionary struggles have temporarily suffered reverses, and in others, the political situation has taken an adverse turn. It blames the setbacks on imperialists and colonialists and neo-colonialists and headed by the United States. Now, we've been subjected to some harsh words by Asian communism and by Asian communists, but I would remind you of what President Johnson has said. We can live with anger in word as long as it is matched by caution in deed. And that is the policy of this country. So I repeat, after an evaluation of what I believe are relevant facts, that things are better in Vietnam militarily than a few months ago. But I also say we must be prepared and steel ourselves for military setbacks and disappointments ahead. I repeat again, we have reason to believe and have reason for, I believe we have reason for measured encouragement. Now, there is no substitute for the use of power in the face of determined attack. There are times when it must be used, but the use of power, necessary as it is and may be, can be counterproductive without accompanying political effort and a credible promise to the people of a better life. So we speak then of a two-front struggle, the military and the social economic. The peasants of Vietnam, and indeed of all Asia, are in many instances rebelling against the kind of a life that they have led for past ages. They want a better day. They want security. They want dignity and self-respect and justice and hope of something better in the future. The communists, in their drive for power, seek to use and subvert these hopes of these people. And if they succeed, we could win many military battles and yet lose the war. The struggle, in fact, will be won or lost in the rural areas. We have said this so often that it almost becomes a cliche. Now it must be proved by programs of action. The Chinese have a saying, lots of noise on the stairs, but nobody enters the room. And I'm afraid we've heard lots of noise on the stairs of social progress. There have been, as I'm fully aware, many promises made to the peasants over the years, but painfully little performance, and the hour is late. The need for deeds as well as words is urgent. In fact, I can tell you that when I traveled with Prime Minister Ky of the Republic of South Vietnam from Honolulu to Saigon, I remember his words, speaking of the Declaration of Honolulu, speaking of his commitment to the social revolution. He said, "I know we're 12 years late, but we're not too late." Now that's why the Vietnamese government, with our support, is pressing this other war. The war against poverty and hunger and disease and ignorance. And this is the theme of the Declaration of Honolulu. I believe that declaration will represent a milestone in the history of our policy in Asia. I think it is the turning point in the relationship of the United States of America to Asia. The people are beginning in earnest the struggle to win and hold the allegiance of the people who live in the rural South Vietnam. This is hard and dangerous work that they're engaged in, because villages and hamlets have been subject to years of Viet Cong terrorism. In 1965 alone, I was told that 354 of the people engaged in what they call the social rural reconstruction were assassinated, and something like 500 wounded. Now, I do not for a moment, therefore, minimize the practical difficulties of carrying out a social revolution by the government of South Vietnam. Vietnam has experienced a quarter of a century of almost constant warfare, as the ambassador from that beleaguered country told this press club some weeks ago. And it's experienced generations of colonial domination and a millennium of Mandarin rule. History has endowed it with no fully ready-made administrative apparatus to undertake a monumental task of reform. It'll have to be carefully built. But I submit there are good human resources there, my fellow Americans. I submit that there are a number of well-trained and educated high and middle-level officials to form the nucleus of this effort, and the American people need to know that. The important thing is to begin. And this the present government has done. Responsibility has been fixed. A spirited attack upon inertia and corruption has been undertaken. I believe that there is a determination that the whole chain of social and political action will be conceived and administered with hard-headedness and efficiency, beginning in the ministries in Saigon and going right down to the village and hamlet level. There may be changes in ministries and in government, but there is a commitment here by the people. High standards of performance have been set, and they're expected. And we're working with the South Vietnamese government at each level to help see that the product matches the expectation. And I would encourage my fellow Americans to give this revolutionary development to which they're committed our highest attention. Today, the South Vietnamese government, late in the day it is true, is trying to meet the pressing needs of the country. Some 800,000 people have fled to government-controlled areas in South Vietnam during the past year and a half. I found, however, that almost 300,000 had been resettled, and I also found that when the refugees move on a road that goes both north and south, they go south. They do not have the chance to express their views at this time by the ballot. So they express their views by walking by their feet. And it is an interesting observation, my fellow Americans, that the refugees do not go towards Hanoi. They go towards Saigon. And the South Vietnamese government, with allied help, is working to house and feed and clothe these refugees. I saw them. In the countryside, schools and hospitals are being built. Not nearly enough, but they're underway. In Saigon, a new constitution is being framed. And the government is working towards a goal of national elections the end of next year. In short, a forced draft effort is being made to create a new society to replace the old. and I think it deserves and requires our support. Now, the country faces staggering economic problems. And I repeat, staggering economic problems. At the top of the list is inflation. But despite that inflation, which must be brought under control, the long-term economic prospect is good. There is new business investment in South Vietnam. The land is rich and productive. The people are energetic and industrious and ambitious. And they're quick to learn new skills. The refugees are learning these new skills, and they're at work. Communications and port facilities and transportation are being expanded and will ever increase in their expansion. But full economic development cannot take place until an environment of violence and conflict is replaced by one of stability and peace. Now, my friends, what I've said does not represent the observations of a weekend expert or a product of a weekend visit in Saigon. To be sure, my visit there, as I said, was informative. It gave me real meaning to what I had read and to the deliberations of government in which I have actively participated. As a student, a professor of government, a senator, and a vice president, I have been intellectually and directly involved in matters of national security and foreign policy. I have read